From the Mellon Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Day two of the teacher strike is underway. We'll hear how the union and district plan to move forward to see about coming to terms on a deal. Plus, a lot of kids did not go to school yesterday. Find out what some of them were doing and how the lack of attendance may cause setbacks all around. And strikes in L.A. have a long history, but one in particular back in 1990 may have set the groundwork for labor battles waged today. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is January 21st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. As you just heard from Suzanne Whatley there in news, get ready to get wet. The projection for this week's storms is up to 8 inches of water. Earlier this morning, evacuations began in some Malibu neighborhoods affected by November's Woolsey fire. We'll get you the latest on those efforts in just a few minutes, and you can always check our website, LAist.com, for more information. First, though, picket lines have formed again at schools across Los Angeles as a teacher strike enters a second day. Educators, counselors, nurses, and other union members all decked out in rain gear holding signs calling for more pay, smaller class sizes, and more resources like school psychologists and librarians. That's a scene from Taft High School in Woodland Hills this morning. Some parents have joined in along with their kids to show support for their teachers. Now, schools remain open, but attendance has been extremely low. The district says that only a third of students showed up yesterday during the first day of the strike, and that has cost LAUSD $15 million already. Now, as of now, it's unclear when this will end. District superintendent has called for the strike to be over. LA Mayor Eric Garcetti has called for a deal. Even new Governor Gavin Newsom weighed in and told the two sides to work it out. To get a sense of where negotiations currently stand, we've got KPCC's education reporter, Kyle Stokes. Hello, Kyle.
Good morning, A.
All right. Earlier this morning, we heard from district officials and the union representing teachers, United Teachers Los Angeles. The union spoke in part about news today that teachers from the Accelerated Schools Charter Network will be joining UTLA members later today for a march, but also had this parting rallying cry.
We are going to win this fight for basic respect for educators and basic respect for our schools. Take pride in your teaching. Take pride in being a teacher. Take pride in being an educator. And take pride in the organizing that you're doing for your rights right now. Thank you very much.
Kyle, all parties have said they don't want to be doing this, that they want to end the strike. What's your sense of when the district and the union will come back to the table?
I don't think that it's going to be anytime soon. The superintendent, Austin Buettner, said this morning that negotiations, at least at this time, are not expected to resume. I don't know when these two sides are going to get back to the table. And I think there's a question about whether there's, who's going to come forward with a concession here. I think both sides are waiting for the other to cave. The district is looking for the union to come back and acknowledge that the district cannot spend as much money as they would like, and they cannot spend this $2 billion that's in the bank for the district. And UTLA, obviously disputes that, but they want the district to come forward and say that there is more money that they can spend. But, I mean, these are just not starting conditions. This is not the groundwork for a compromise at this point.
Is there maybe one thing the district can offer that might catch the attention of the union?
I mean, I think this class size issue is such a toxic issue, it's toxic because both sides see the safety valve that's in the contract that allows the district to raise class sizes whenever it wants. The district sees that as essential. They need that because class size reduction is costly. They need to be able to save money. The union needs that gone in order for there to be in order for them to feel like they're making a real progress on class size. So there are cost neutral ways of getting rid of that provision, but I think it's very difficult, and the two sides just are not there right now.
New Governor Gavin Newsom has weighed in. LA Mayor Eric Garcetti weighed in on this show yesterday. Anything either can do at this point to bring both sides together?
Well, it's just the issue of basic trust. And, you know, you talk about, you know, you put this all, you know, you take it out of the media and you put it into a room and you have these two storylines try and talk to each other through their appointed representatives, through UTLA yeah. people and through district people sitting in a room trying to work out a deal. They're butting heads and clashing and not making any progress. And so the thought is if you bring in a third party, maybe they're going to be able to force the two sides to actually engage with each other's ideas and get to a deal. But clearly both – I mean, that is what bringing in a third party at this stage can do. When there is no trust between the people, the actual people that are negotiating this, maybe a third party can help create an environment where that trust might exist. That's the plus side of this. Obviously, a lot of downsides to it too.
All right, now to the kids. And for this, I'm going to bring in KPCC reporter Emily Elena Dugdale. She's been at Taft High School this morning in Woodland Hills. Hey, Emily, how you doing?
Hey, how are you?
Good. Now, only a third of students went to school yesterday, but for those kids who are going to school, what are they doing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I talked to a few kids. You know, we're not getting a huge sense of what the kids inside the schools are doing, but the kids that I have talked to, sounds like a lot of sitting in auditoriums, watching movies. I did hear that one student at Roosevelt High School in Boyle Heights actually said they sat in an auditorium and they watched a documentary and then they wrote about the documentary. So kind of the things that we've been hearing seem to be true. The kids are just kind of all in one group and watching a lot of movies.
Kyle, you spoke to high school students yesterday. How are they feeling about this?
Yeah, they're feeling definitely conflicted about this. I talked to Kevin Castillo, who is a senior at Reseda Charter High School, which is an LAUSD-run school.
I mean, we shouldn't be rejoicing because a lot of us have important classes, such as our AP classes, and we're missing out on that. And I feel like it could affect us by our grades lowering. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, overall, the teachers are doing this for us.
So it's a very complicated feeling for students. At Reseda, they were, you know, the principal there said that they were doing the absolute best that they could to try and provide educational things for them to do. They were doing some of the things, you know, on laptops in the gym that are like college prep programs. There were going to be some students who were going to be doing tests. All of it, things that normally they would have to be pulled out of their core classes to do. But just to echo what Emily Elena Dugdale was saying, there were also a lot of kids just kind of playing basketball, sitting around on their phones. They were watching TED Talks for part of the day. There's only so much that the people, even these principals who they're doing the best they can, they're trying to provide as educational an experience as they can do, but it certainly is not optimal.
That student mentioned AP classes, advanced placement classes. I mean, there's a real fear then, I guess, that students could fall behind, especially if some students don't have college locked up yet.
It's a significant amount of prep time that they could be losing for things like advanced placement tests, which come up. They always creep up on you and they're always there sooner than you think. Definite disruption to their actual coursework. I have heard tell, and in fact, we've sent Emily in search of any news on the ground about whether or not teachers have left students with like marching orders. Like while we're out on strike, we've heard tell that their teachers who are providing prep, you know, instructions for AP students, I have heard that there are some teachers who have given those marching orders and maybe students are able to benefit from those. But if they're in school, they're clearly not getting an optimal learning experience.
Emily, what else are you hearing from students and their parents?
Yeah, you know, just to touch on what Kyle just said, I haven't heard that at this school yet. I'm not saying it hasn't happened, but from parents and parents and their kids, there's some frustration. You know, I talked to some parents who are a little, you know, like irked about the disruption to their schedule. They're a little worried about the education for their children. Also yesterday when I was around, I talked to parents who actually didn't know that the strike was going on still.
What? Even still?
That's still happening. And again, that's a lot of our non-English speakers, a lot of Spanish language folks, Spanish speaking folks that I was talking to were still a little confused about what was going on. Then again, there were definitely parents who, you know, are on the picket line today. There were parents here present with their children. There was actually children of teachers who were here, too, and they even go to a different high school and they were here. So there definitely is support from parents and teachers as well.
Kyle, just to clarify, if kids do not go to school, it's an unexcused absence.
That's right.
Right. So what does that do in terms of funding for schools?
Well, what it does for funding for schools is that it takes it away. I mean, the school district is funded based on how many students actually show up. The school district, as you said, estimates that they lost about $15 million. That's about $25 million in lost revenue minus the $10 million that they pay daily in UTLA wages to UTLA members. So it is a loss of funding for the school district. Every day that this strike goes on is going to be a hit to the bottom line.
Emily, one last question for you. You've been out on the picket line with teachers for a couple of days now. It's been going to be raining all day today, the rest of the week as well. What's your sense of teacher stamina here? These aren't pleasant conditions. They're not getting paid. I think it would be a legit question even if it were sunny and 70, but what about the rest of the week? What about their enthusiasm and stamina for this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I was a little surprised, too. Like, I got drenched yesterday in the rain, but a lot of these teachers did, too. But they're still out here, and the energy is really high on day two. It has not lost any of that fire and energy from day one. You know, I talked to a lot of teachers here who did say, you know, this is going to be a financial hit for me. I talked to a teacher here, an English teacher, who said she just canceled her gym membership. You know, she's cutting back on self-care. Those little extra things that, you know, we all like. I like going to the gym. And, you know, she said she likes going to the gym, but she needs to cut back because she has, you know, loans to pay, car payments. So these are all things that are cropping up in the minds of these teachers here, you know, but they say it's worth it. It's worth it for the students and the education.
Kyle, I don't think anybody wants to think that both sides are digging in here. But, I mean, what do you think?
They're digging in,
wow.
They're digging in. I mean, this is not a, you know, a situation where we're going to have a quick resolution. I think a week at least at this point, is sort of my sense of where this is going. And that might be conservative at this point.
KPCC's Kyle Stokes and Emily Elena Dugdale, thank you very much. And we're going to continue the coverage of the teacher strike all day right here at KPCC. Keep your ears right here. All right, moving on to that rain that we were talking about that's prompted evacuations throughout Southern California. A series of storms will continue to drench us all week long. As a result of yesterday's rains, evacuation orders are in place for parts of Malibu that burned during November's Woolsey Fire. Also in parts of Riverside County that burned during last April's Holy Fire. For an update on conditions and evacuations, we have Pono Barnes with the LA County Fire Department. Welcome back to Take Two.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, yesterday we spoke with you while it was raining about conditions in Malibu. That rain continued all day yesterday. Now parts of Pacific Coast Highway have been closed because of a mudslide. What more can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so yesterday we had a portion of PCH kind of between Broad Beach and Las Poses that experienced some minor mud debris flow. Caltrans was out there in force working hard to get that road open, and it was open later on in the evening and is open right now. We have a slight break in the rain this morning, but we're expected to see pretty significant rain starting early or kind of early this afternoon.
Now, this morning, starting at 8, about an hour ago, parts of Malibu were ordered to evacuate. What specific areas are we talking about?
Yeah, so we had sheriff's deputies and Los Angeles County fire crews out in the neighborhood starting yesterday evening as a advance notice for the evacuation of specific parcels of land in the Woolsey Fire burn area. And so that's going to be kind of in the Malibu Park area and then that Ramirez Canyon area. So pretty much anywhere where there are homes or residents along steep hillsides and at the bottom of ranges or low-lying areas.
How are the evacuations going, considering, Pono, that parts of Pacific Coast Highway are closed right now?
Yeah, so evacuations have been going very well.
Okay, good.
Our residents in the areas have been preparing, and we'd like to thank them for being ready to go and heeding the warnings. When those evacuation orders are issued, it's not a time to be thinking about going. You should be ready to go already. You should have done that preparation in advance.
And you would think it goes without saying, but if anybody out there is not in Malibu, doesn't live in Malibu, they should probably be nowhere near the Malibu area right now.
Yeah, absolutely. There are definitely a lot of crews in the area. We'd like to minimize traffic in that Woolsey Fire burn area as much as possible.
Now, it's been slowing. It's been slowly raining this morning. It's supposed to come back really, really bad later today. How are you guys preparing for those areas in Malibu that were really burned during November's Woolsey Fire?
Yeah, so we're out in force. We're in unified command with Department of Public Works, Los Angeles County Fire Department, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and our partnering agencies, Caltrans, and the City of Malibu. We have a number of pieces of heavy equipment out there to maintain those roads and provide access to our rescue personnel and our residents. I would like to thank our residents for preparing their homes. A lot of work was done on their part, preparing their properties, putting in diversion or sandbags and berms, and diverting that water off of their properties to help us get access to them should we need to.
Fono, based on weather forecasts, I mean, what are you expecting will happen once the rain kicks in again? I mentioned earlier, there's going to be a lot of rain coming down at a short amount of time.
Yeah, we're hoping for the best, absolutely. But we're preparing for the worst. Like I said, we had our a really good messaging way out in advance of these storms, immediately after the Woolsey fire itself. So in partnership with our residents and our communities, we're prepared and we're ready for it.
Pono Barnes is with the Los Angeles County Fire Department. He's been speaking with us about the evacuations and road closures in Malibu as a result of this week's rains. Pono, thank you very much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you. Have a great day.
And just a reminder, you can count on KPCC for full coverage of the LAUSD teacher strike. That's 89.3 KPCC and LAIST.com. If you want more information, that's LAIST.com. Coming up next, though, a federal judge says no to adding a citizenship question on the 2020 census. He called it unlawful and that it must be set aside, but the Trump administration will likely appeal that decision. Coming up next, we'll hear about the road this issue will travel on its likely way to the Supreme Court. That's ahead when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right, we got some big news for you. Starting Tuesday, you can hear Take Two at 2 p.m. every single weekday. This makes sure KPCC listeners get our signature local public affairs shows. That's Air Talk and Take Two in the morning and in the afternoon. So I know you're wondering now what's going to happen at 9 a.m. Well, we're adding a brand new show. It's The Takeaway with Tenzia Vega, an in-depth look at national and international news and issues. So The Takeaway weekday mornings at 9 and then Take Two at 2. Moving on, a federal judge in New York has ruled against a Trump administration effort to add a question about American citizenship to the 2020 census. The Commerce Department, which oversees the Census Bureau, pushed for the question despite a recommendation against it by the Bureau itself. Coalition of advocacy groups argued the move could give Republicans a political upper hand. Now, today in a scathing ruling, Judge Jesse Furman said the Commerce Secretary committed, quote, a smorgasbord of federal violations in ordering the question. Let's get more from Hansi Lo Wang, national correspondent for NPR covering the 2020 census. Welcome back, Hansi.
Thank you, A.
All right, so let's get a rewind for people who have not been following this saga. When all of this started, what was the proposed reason why the question, the citizenship question, would be added to the census in the first place?
Well, when this proposal to add a citizenship question became public, the stated reason from the Trump administration was that the Justice Department wanted responses from a citizenship question on the 2020 census to better enforce part of the Voting Rights Act, specifically Section 2, which has protections against racial discrimination and also discrimination of language minorities in terms of their voting rights. But digging through emails and memos released as part of the lawsuits, it's really unclear if that exactly was the reason that really prompted the Trump administration and the Commerce Department and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to push for this question. There were lots of discussion about are non-citizens and specifically unauthorized immigrants, are they included in census numbers used to distribute congressional seats after the census count? That was one question hanging in the air. And now This judge in New York, federal judge, U.S. District Judge Jesse Furman, has written in his opinion in explaining why he believes this decision to add a citizenship question was unlawful. He says that this was not the real rationale of Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and he really questions that the Voting Rights Act, that was used as a cover to add this citizenship question.
And the other part of this is advocacy groups express concern that having this question would discourage non-citizens from participating in the census. What could have been the effect of such a move?
Well, the Census Bureau has actually done research that it's released itself that suggests that asking about citizenship status in this current political climate of increased immigration enforcement, that this question is especially sensitive to households with non-citizens, and that can affect the accuracy of information collected, not just about non-citizens and unauthorized immigrants, but about some citizens who have connections to people who are non-citizens, that people are very unsure about what the federal government could use this information for. Although it's important to really remind folks that federal law prohibits the Census Bureau from releasing information that identifies individuals until 72 years after it's collected, but a lot of people are not trusting that policy.
Not having an accurate census, though, Hanzi, what was the argument that could give an upper hand to Republicans?
Well, these numbers, the census numbers, directly impact how many congressional seats each state gets. And that impacts the Electoral College. How many Electoral College votes each state gets is dependent on these population numbers. And some people said that if you were to have a dramatic undercount of immigrant communities, non-citizen communities, that may give Republicans an upper hand. It's unclear right now exactly what that impact would be, because if you think about it, a lot of parts of the country, the heartland, if you will, there are growing numbers of immigrants, non-citizens living in those parts. And so there could be impacts on both sides of the political aisle. Here.
Mentioned how the judge, Jesse Furman, said it was a smorgasbord of federal violations. What were those violations?
Well, one of them is a violation of what is known as the Administrative Procedure Act, and specifically, as I mentioned before, that the stated reason of adding this question by the Trump administration was not the real reason, the judge concluded. Another reason is that the judge said that essentially, Secretary Wilbur Ross made the wrong call here, that the Census Bureau urged him to not add a citizenship question if he wanted better citizenship data, to instead use existing government records, which the Census Bureau concluded would be more accurate if you really wanted to better enforce the Voting Rights Act to have better citizenship data. But Secretary Ross overruled those recommendations, and that is one of the reasons why Judge Furman here says that it is unlawful for this question to be added.
Big picture, Hanzi, what does this ruling mean?
This is a milestone, a big milestone. This is not the end of the story. I will keep tracking this because it is likely to go to the Supreme Court. This is going to be one of the big legal fights, and this is going to impact everyone over the next decade. So keep your eye on it.
It is going to go there, right? I mean, there is all the indications show that it's going to go to the Supreme Court.
We'll still have to watch, but the Trump administration in its emails have said that it was planning to this will end up at the Supreme Court. So we'll see.
Now, and it's worth mentioning that this decision comes about a year before the census is set up to start in Alaska. Does that mean there's enough time for it to go all the way through to the Supreme Court?
That's another big question here. June is when printing of the census forms has to start. That's when the printers need to know exactly what questions will be on these census forms for people filling it out on paper. And the big question is, can this be resolved through the courts by June? The courts have a lot of discretion here in terms of the timing, but there is this very strict timeline that if the Census Bureau misses these deadlines coming up before the census starts in Alaska, we can be in some big trouble in terms of having a successful count in 2020.
Hanzi, keep your phone ringer on. We're going to call you back on this, all right?
No problem.
That's Hanzi Lo Wang, national correspondent for NPR, covering the 2020 census. All right, to housing now. Voters were asked back in November to approve tighter rent control regulations. They said no to that ballot measure. This has prompted discussion about other ways to stabilize the amounts that tenants pay for their rentals in California. As part of our coverage of the California Dream, KPBS's Amitha Sharma says some mayors want state lawmakers to approve anti-price gouging rules to slow the rate of rent increases.
Crooning in the shower is not Chad Vergese's thing. That's why, when he learned earlier this year his monthly rent would go up $300 so the new owners of his La Mesa apartment could upgrade his bathroom with a sound system, he was bemused.
$300 for an iPod is like less than that. Everybody's got a phone now, and like, who needs a Bluetooth speaker in their bathroom apartment? You know, it's weird.
This VA employee and surfer was also, as he puts it, bummed.
The amount it was going up didn't match, like, the condition of the apartment. You know, I mean, it's like, if you're going to live downtown, you're expecting like a baller apartment, right?
But he felt powerless to challenge his new landlords on the rent hike.
I mean, who's going to tell him no? You know, because I mean, it's like, there's no rules to how far your rent can go up.
That's true in most California cities. In some, there are rules, but others have no rent control. And a statewide measure that would have allowed cities to add it failed in November. Now, talk is underway about putting a law on the books that would bar California landlords from raising rent beyond a certain percentage.
Since it seems like rent control seems to give people pause, we are going to talk about anti-rent gouging regulations. Mm-hmm.
Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf said at a mayor's forum in November, the rule would mimic current limits, barring businesses from raising prices by more than 10% during natural disasters.
Just like when there's a fire, you pass an anti-rent gouging ordinance. The state has had a fire. It's called a housing crisis.
At that same forum, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti said voter rejection of a rent control initiative last year is no excuse for complacency.
It is not going to be good enough to just say, well, the voters spoke. We have a problem we have to confront.
Garcetti wants the state legislature to approve an anti-price gouging rent cap, and it appears backing of such a cap is building. Democratic State Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco says legislators are mulling over whether to pitch a bill that would classify rent increases in the state as if they were occurring during an emergency. He says the state is short millions of homes.
That shortage is leading to displacement, evictions, people becoming homeless, working families, leaving young people, not having stable housing.
Wiener says the obvious solution is to build more housing.
Until we get there, we need to take action to keep people stable in the housing that they have.
David Garcia, who is policy director at UC Berkeley's Turner Center for Housing Innovation, says a 10% cap would protect tenants from the most egregious rent increases.
For example, tenants receiving increases of, say, 25, 30, 40%, which we read about all the time, those increases would be illegal.
But housing advocates like Rafael Bautista of San Diego's Tenants United worry. He says the state still needs real rent control that restricts annual increases to 2%. He believes that the proposed anti-gouging cap is a ruse.
They're basically a watered-down version so that we don't pursue rent control, because they'll point to that and say, well, you know, we have these measures in place. Why do you still need rent control?
Back in La Mesa, Chad Vergese thinks the cap would be a good start.
You know, I mean, obviously people are buying these properties to make money. It's a business game. And this is America. You should be able to do that, right? But at the same time, though, you shouldn't be just like crushing people, you know, because you want to be greedy.
Vergese moved out of his apartment following the $300 rent increase, but his new place just got new owners. And now he's nervous that could mean a new rent increase. In San Diego, I'm Amita Sharma.
This story is part of our statewide California Dream collaboration. All right, day two of the teacher strike. 30,000 LAUSD teachers affected, 600,000 students, hundreds of thousands of parents across campuses all over the city. You can count on KPCC for full coverage. Listen for updates on 89.3 KPCC and then find the latest news on our website, laist.com. That's LAIST.com. Coming up, strikes in L.A. have a long history, but find out how one in particular back in 1990 involving L.A. janitors may have set the groundwork for labor battles today. That's coming up when Take Two continues.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by January 21st to be considered for a $4,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Current teacher strike in Los Angeles isn't the first to hit the city. The last one happened in 1989. And over the years, hotel workers, garment workers, janitors, and other laborers have protested for better pay and better working conditions. For more on the history of major strikes in Los Angeles and their ripple effects, we have Eric Loomis. He's a labor historian at the University of Rhode Island and author of The History of America in 10 Strikes. Eric, welcome to Take 2.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Now, you've been following the current teacher strike in L.A. As a labor historian, Eric, what's the one thing that stands out to you so far?
You know, placing it in the context of the broader teacher strikes that have been happening through the United States, teachers in Los Angeles, but also in West Virginia, in Oklahoma, and in some of the other places that these teacher strikes have been taking place, they are really centering community concerns as much as wages and hours and working conditions. And I think that that kind of community strategy is something that can be very effective for unions. It can be very effective for the labor movement. And I think is really indicative of the way that the Los Angeles teachers are framing this action.
Is there anything in particular, you mentioned different teacher strikes around the country, that is maybe causing or inspiring teachers to go out there on the picket line? Because it's one thing to threaten to strike, but then to actually go through with it. I'm wondering if there's anything you've noticed.
Striking can be scary. You know, it's not something that is a common thing that most of us see anymore. If this was 1947 or 1954, sure. Today, that's very uncommon. Strikes are much, much less common than they used to be. And the idea of walking off the job and potentially giving up pay to go on strike is something that is naturally something pretty frightening for most of us. And so I think that when you see other people strike, when you hear about it on the news, when you see it in person, it's something that inspires you, that you can do this yourself. And when you see other, in this case, you see other teachers go on strike in states and cities far, far more conservative than Los Angeles, California, and you see them win, you realize that this is a strategy that can work for you, and it becomes much less scary.
Now, Eric, you mentioned the word win. I'm wondering, when these disputes happen, how do they typically resolve? Is it with a compromise, or does one side usually come out as a winner, or is there a clear-cut winner typically?
Well, usually it is some sort of a compromise. I mean, I would say that so far that these teacher strikes have tended to come out in pretty significant victories for the teachers. Thinking about in 2018, I mean, in West Virginia, you know, where this really began in February and ended up with 5% pay raise for teachers in Oklahoma that goes out on strike or went out on strike in April. It led to a $6,000 raise for teachers, a $1,250 raise for support staff, and most importantly, increased public school funding. And this is, I think, really important because it kind of frames what Los Angeles teachers are doing right now, right? And I think that in this kind of a case, you know, a compromise is something that I think everybody is probably very interested in. A compromise could be a win, too.
We're talking about the history of strikes in Los Angeles with Eric Loomis. He's a labor historian at the University of Rhode Island, author of The History of America in 10 Strikes. Now, going back in that history, Eric, there have been strikes among all kinds of laborers, including a significant one that you wrote about in your book involving L.A. janitors. What can you tell us about that one?
Right. The most important strike in Los Angeles history is what's called the Justice for Janitors campaign. This was a case where janitors were unionized, generally low-wage workers, but they had unions. And what happens in the 1980s is that the building owners themselves are consolidated. And as they consolidate under a couple of large companies, they bust those union contracts. The wages for these janitors plummet. And so these janitors start picketing outside of these large buildings. And all this leads to pressure. And finally, in 1990, the Los Angeles police decides to break up one of these actions through violence. And they break a guy's skull, a pregnant woman, miscarriages. And this really changes the rhetoric around this, leading to a lot of condemnation of both Los Angeles police and the building owners. And this becomes one of the great victories of the labor movement over the last 30 to 40 years.
Eric, what to you is revealing about the sectors of the U.S. economy that wind up striking?
Well, you know, these days, a lot of it tends to be public sector workers. You know, I mean, back if you look at the 1950s or something, you know, it's the United Auto Workers, the United Steel Workers, America had these big industries. And these industries are pretty much gone now. And so, you know, in many ways, these teachers represent the average worker in America these days. And I think it's one reason why these strikes have been relatively successful. because teachers are very respected members of our community. And yet, because of decades of poor funding of education from both Republican and Democratic government, teachers are really struggling. A lot of them are working second jobs, and they're resorting to these strikes. You know, I think that the fact that the teachers are leading on this actually says a lot about where our economy is today and what sectors are really important.
You know, Eric, as we're talking, the federal government is partially shut down, yet hundreds of thousands of workers are required to work without pay. I'm wondering, do air traffic controllers and TSA workers have grounds to strike, as some labor activists have suggested in recent days?
Well, you know, technically, a strike would be illegal. Federal workers are not allowed to strike. That doesn't mean they have not struck in the past. That said, these TSA workers and air traffic controllers really have a tremendous amount of power right now. And whether it's an official strike or more of an unofficial, what we would call a sick out, where, you know, we've already heard stories about TSA agents who are, you know, who are calling in sick because, you know, they're not getting paid and they need to take care of their kids or whatever for whatever reason. And if that became more organized and they didn't call it a strike, it would be very powerful. You know, if airports were effectively shut down because these TSA workers and air traffic controllers said, this is unacceptable and I'm going to take my sick time or I'm not going to show up to work, that would probably be the single biggest thing that could end a government shutdown. And moreover, I think it would be very popular.
Eric Loomis is a labor historian with the University of Rhode Island and author of the book, The History of America in 10 Strikes. Eric, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you for having me.
All right, to health now. A 4-year-old boy in Riverside died from the flu over the weekend, bringing the total number of flu deaths in the state to 52 this season. The flu is especially dangerous to children and pregnant women, according to the Centers for Disease Control, which continues to urge people to get their flu shots, even if they've already done so, even haven't already done so. Flu season typically runs from October through May, but it peaks in February.
The flu is really a year-round phenomenon. We just see more of it during the winter and early spring. So there is still a benefit to receiving your flu shot, even if you're relatively late in the season. In general, we recommend when the flu shot becomes available, October, November is the best time to go. If you're able to get it and you haven't done so yet, protect yourself and protect your family. Go out and avail yourself of it. It only takes a minute.
Cameron Kaiser is health officer for Riverside County. Everyone over the age of 6 months is encouraged to get a flu shot, which reduces the risk of catching the flu and makes symptoms less severe for people who still get it even after they've received the shot. The majority of children who died from the flu last year had not received one. And experts suggest the shot reduces a pregnant woman's chance of catching the flu by 40% while also providing immunity for the baby. Now, staying with health.
Life can change in an instant. Be covered when it does with a health plan through Covered California.
Today is a deadline to sign up for 2019 health coverage through the Affordable Care Act. Official deadline is midnight tonight for Covered California, the state's insurance marketplace set up under the ACA. Covered California includes plans from 11 different insurance providers, including large companies such as Kaiser Permanente and Anthem Blue Cross, as well as small insurers. For more information, visit coveredca.com. We're continuing to cover the teacher strike in Los Angeles. 30,000 teachers on strike, 600,000 students affected across hundreds of campuses. Count on KPCC for full coverage. Listen for updates right here on 89.3 KPCC and find the latest on our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. Coming up, find out how funding and where the money is spent and how it's spent has been a long time in the making in this debate. That's coming up when Take 2 continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Ever wondered why we have KPCC's signature local news shows, Take 2 and Air Talk, back-to-back in the mornings? Well, yeah, we've been wondering, too. Now, we're making sure you get all the Southern California news you need in the mornings and in the afternoons. We're moving Take 2 to 2 p.m. That's starting next Tuesday. And at 9 a.m., we think you'll enjoy the national news show, The Takeaway, with Tanzia Vega. The Takeaway weekday mornings at 9 and then Take 2 at 2. Teachers in Los Angeles Unified School District continue to strike outside their respective schools today. Negotiations between the district and the union representing educators, United Teachers Los Angeles, are deadlocked, and it's unclear when the two sides will return to the negotiating table. However, the fight over funding that has led to this current conflict has been decades in the making all across the state, and there's a lot at stake. Miriam Powell is contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. She lives here and has been writing about the strike. Miriam, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Now, in your article, you make the point that this strike didn't just manifest overnight. You trace the roots back to 1978. Set the scene for us back in 1978.
Well, as I think many people will remember or certainly have heard about, Proposition 13 is what happened in June of 1978. It was the culmination of a lot of unhappiness about rising property tax levels, and it changed so many things about how we live in California today, 40 years later, and school financing was one of them. It was not the only factor. It was kind of a perfect storm that came together in 1978. We also had a lot of busing controversies going on then. Actually, the seminal busing case came out of Pasadena, and then Los Angeles struggled for many years to figure out a way to first voluntarily and then involuntarily through mandatory busing integrate its schools. And in 1978, that was done for the first time, 1,000 buses, 40,000 kids in the fall. And there was tremendous white flight out of the school district following that. And that has continued for many years. So you sort of had that the middle class, and particularly the white middle class, pulling out and abdicating in some ways responsibility for the schools at the same time that the entire system of financing schools in not only Los Angeles but California was in flux because of Prop 13. Prop 13, of course, limited districts' abilities to raise taxes on their own.
It's seen as a housing market proposition, not anything that directly affects schools. At least that's the first, the top of mind thing that people think of when they think of Prop 13.
But it changed the way money was raised for the state and for local governments, you know, in this really massive way. So when Prop 13 passed, it rolled back the tax rates to earlier levels, and that cost the state $7 billion in revenue right away. It was a huge hit because people got rebates on their taxes in effect. And just to complicate matters further, there was a very famous court case called the Serrano case, went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which challenged the equity of the property tax funding system for school districts, because districts that were wealthier, that had higher property values, could raise a lot more money for their schools than poor districts. And so that was challenged in court. And all this kind of came together in ways that ultimately centralized decisions about school financing in Sacramento.
How was this allowed to happen, Miriam? What were the forces at play?
We did it. We, the people of California. Prop 13 was incredibly popular. It still is incredibly popular, as you know.
But no one could foresee the ripple effects down the road back then?
I think that there were a lot of unforeseen consequences of it, and there were a lot of people who believed that services would not really fundamentally be affected, that there's lots of money wasted, you know, we're going to find that. And what people cared about then was very much the issue of staying in their homes and not being priced out of their homes because of this incredible, you know, very, very rapidly property tax rising.
That was 41 years ago, Miriam, though. I mean, it's still residual effects today, 41 years later.
Oh, absolutely, because you then have a series of other propositions and attempts to sort of fix things by, it's partly our tendency to govern by initiative in this state, Prop 98, which was an attempt to guarantee that a certain amount of financing would go to schools. That has a very convoluted formula that has complicated budgeting in Sacramento even further. And then, you know, to come back to the busing issue and the racial composition of the school district, you know, you have a district that has become increasingly Latino, increasingly low income, and people who in many ways have the least voice in electoral politics. I think that's changing. I hope that's changing. But to some extent, you had people who were the people who could afford to pay money who were not that interested and didn't have a personal stake in school districts like Los Angeles United.
Talking to Miriam Powell, contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. Now, Miriam, you outlined the issues on the bargaining table throughout this strike of LA Unified teachers, salaries, class sizes, counselor and nurses working too much as big ones. You say the one big issue, though, is not directly present. That's the future of charter schools. Why is that the most potent issue, in your opinion?
I think it goes to sort of the heart of the debate over whether sort of we as a society are going to support public education, and that's the argument of the teachers' union. This is not to say that charter schools are all bad. There's some terrific charter schools, but what has been happening is that as enrollment in the district is declining, their costs are fixed, their retiree pension costs are ballooning and so forth. So you have a financial squeeze where they have ongoing costs with declining numbers of students, and their state aid is determined per pupil. So the fewer students they have, the less money they get. And then you have charters which have been growing very, very rapidly and, in effect, competing for those students. And then the charter, the money follows the students. So it is pulling money out of the district. And there is a sense on the part of the teachers' union that the district is very supportive of that. And there's lots of reasons to think that. In the most recent election, in the school board elections in 2017, the charter school advocates spent $10 million to get their candidates elected to the board, and they did have a majority on the board until the president was forced to resign in a scandal. But during the time that the charter folks had the majority, they hired the current superintendent, Austin Buettner. So there is a dynamic that has been set up of the charter advocates versus the regular teachers and the union, and that's unfortunate. But
Miriam, you mentioned though how the money follows the students. Why couldn't we foresee that to try and plan ahead a little bit? If the money's going to follow a student somewhere else, how about a way to kind of make sure that all the money doesn't go in a certain direction?
Well, the money follows the students into the charter schools, and the people who believe that charter schools are a better way of educating the students in LA Unified are supportive of that. So it's not by accident. It's really by design that there has been this move. Now, one of the ongoing issues on the state level that the governor addressed yesterday is there have been sort of calls for greater transparency and regulation over charter schools. Has said that he will do something about that. So, that may be part of addressing this whole situation.
Now, among other things, this is the first strike since the Supreme Court's Janus decision last year. Walk us through why this is significant.
The Janus decision was brought by anti-union forces, and it was designed to make it, their hope was to break the unions in many ways, the public employee unions. It makes it much more difficult for public employee unions to keep and retain members in the sense that members are not required to join the union. That was expected to really decimate the ranks of public employee unions, particularly the teachers, but it actually, in fact, interestingly, has not had that effect. The unions have had to go out and really organize their members and give them a reason to join the union as opposed to sort of taking them for granted. And we're seeing an interesting actual surge in membership in public employee unions. And the teacher strike is a interesting example of that. It's, there have been teacher strikes around the country last year, but those strikes tended to be in very Republican red states where unions were not powerful. And of course, here in California, we're in a somewhat different situation, not only very strong Democratic control of the various levels of government, but also labor has traditionally been very strong and powerful, both in Los Angeles and in Sacramento. It's an interesting example of perhaps a resurgent labor movement. We'll see.
Miriam, you say the strike comes at a pivotal moment for California schools. There have been glimmers of hope. What are those?
Well, the funding, you know, school funding was cut very, very severely during the Great Recession when the state was having so many difficulties. And we are now, there have been, I think it's $23 billion in increased aid over the last 5 years to schools and proposals to increase that, of course, even further next year. So we are starting to climb out from a real decline. Not that money is the only issue here in terms of quality education, but there has been a kind of renewed, I think, public commitment to schools. There is more of an alignment between the people who vote and the people who send their kids to public schools. That for a long time was, there was a big disparity. So I think this strike is really going to be an interesting illustration. I mean, we don't know where this is going to end. And one of the questions is whether there will be some leadership that emerges in, you know, how, to what extent does the civic community of Los Angeles want to take responsibility and ownership over the school?
Miriam Powell is contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. She's been writing about the strike. Miriam, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. Air Talk with Larry Mantle is next. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Abe. We're up to the latest on day two of the LA Unified strike. Hear from parents about what their students did in class yesterday.
Heard watching movies.
Yeah.
Film week, maybe. Kind of
sounds good.
Air Talk with Larry Mantle is next. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks, Abe.